Another week and another chat with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy on our Tacky Talks. How are you doing today, Tacky?
Doing good, Joe. Good to see you again another week as we close into the holiday schedule.
I know. We were just talking before we started recording about how it just kind of all of a sudden appeared upon us this year. I don't know why. It's the same time every year, but it just seemed to come quick this year.
Well, it's like daily savings time creeping on all of us, right? Before we know it, things are here. And as we talked a lot, COVID really changes our perception of time because of how we work. A lot of us are still working remote, regardless of vaccination status, because of convenience for employers in many ways. And some of us, obviously still front-facing jobs are out there. But even then, we know there's a workforce shortage. There's some challenges associated with people getting here, vaccination rates, and also supply chain problems. I mean, inflation is now driven by both a supply chain and a higher labor cost. So I think everyone's feeling all around, but you know, in a strange way, a lot of things we're feeling at one time, both economically, personally, and now calendar wise.
Yeah, there is a lot going on for sure. And now, unfortunately, cases are climbing again. What do you think about that?
Well, we're back indoors. This is not necessarily surprising. There are more breakthrough cases, so to speak, cases of vaccinated individuals who are contracted COVID and need some minimal hospitalization. There are still very, very low numbers of severe cases associated with vaccinated folks, but they generally always involve an underlying condition. Most people in severe health issues from COVID are those who are unvaccinated. So I'm not saying it's 100% by any measure, folks. It's not 100% people severe, but the vast majority are people unvaccinated. They're having severe medical problems. And those, again, who are vaccinated with severe medical problems have underlying conditions that are complicating the matter. And these complications may not always be COVID-related in the sense they had other things going on prior to contracting COVID. So you have to be conscientious of that as well. And flu season's rolling around. I've had several colds already. This year, it's been kind of roller coaster weather, and even I've been indoors a slight bit more than I have, obviously, since the past summer, and I probably am going to restrain my movements indoors a bit as well as we get closer to colder weather. But flu season is around, colds will pick up, the dreaded norovirus that everyone knows about, that one is going to be making the rounds too. So, again, you know, mask wearing still has a value. It proved last time out. It reduces the transmission of respiratory diseases, including things like the flu. And hand washing, particularly, you know, using the restroom, contact surfaces, cooking, keeping your hands clean reduces the possibility of transmission of foodborne illnesses, as well as any other surface contact illnesses you may have.
Yeah, all the things. And now there are potentially breakthrough treatments in the pill form for COVID. So it's kind of interesting to watch this unfold and see what the future holds.
Yeah, I was just talking to the government affairs person for AstraZeneca this morning. I do actually take calls in the mornings. People know I hate mornings, but it does happen sometimes. And he was actually, his client's AstraZeneca, and they do have another therapeutic coming online that is very oral-based, very easy to use, that will be looking for emergency approval from the FDA very soon. So there are more therapeutics underway. However, I hear arguments that because it's therapeutics, I don't need to take a vaccine. Well, to be frank with you, I don't want to get to a therapeutic.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Prevention is always the best course of action with any disease.
Well, it's like saying I can eat rotted food because I can get get Pepto-Bismol, or I can have alcohol poisoning because it can pump my stomach.
Right.
I mean, the logic doesn't make sense. I can do self-destructive behavior because there's a solution to my problem. So intentionally become self-destructive because there's a solution. I mean, that is not smart thinking. It's not even self-preservation thinking. So while there are going to be more ways to treat COVID-19 to prevent severe illness or death, it's best not to find you in a situation of severe illness or death. I would rather have mild symptoms where I can treat some Tylenol and some cold medicine and some sleep rather than find myself needing to go to a hospital and get diagnosed and then decide they need to give me a therapeutic.
Exactly. Yeah, it's pretty clear cut. Absolutely. But it is encouraging, I guess, to see that there are advances that are happening even amidst the pandemic.
Well, that's exactly it. And there'll be more progress if this continues. And we are seeing more FDA approved, at least emergency approved therapeutics coming down the road. And some people are always very critical of the vaccine because it's been emergency approved. But these therapeutics are emergency approved too. And I've not seen people saying that, you know, saying that, oh, I got COVID and I'm not taking that emergency approved therapeutic because it's not been tested and tried properly. I'm like, yeah, but you won't get a vaccine.
Right. I know. I know.
You know, there's a logic hole here that I think a lot of us are struggling with when in conversation with people where, you know, it's like risk assessment. Well, what's your risk? Well, the risk isn't to me. The risk is to everyone else around you. This is the part that, again, people keep the fit. That the point of so-called herd immunity is that if people do their part, it keeps the disease from transmitting and it keeps away from people with high-risk conditions, and especially high-risk conditions, especially people older or people with health issues, severe health issues. Because as we've seen, vaccination does help everybody. However, if you have underlying conditions that get complicated and COVID shows up, it makes it worse.
Yeah.
So, you know, if everyone does their part and the disease stops with you, you know, you are potentially saving life of others. And, you know, and I hate to guilt trip people, but, you know, if you gave a disease to or COVID to somebody else, I mean, should you take responsibility for that matter? I mean, you're drunk driving, you kill someone with a car. Should you take, you know, we make you responsible for that. You know, in the case you've got a disease that has a 2% kill rate, but also a, you know, 10 to 50% severe illness rate and, you know, almost 40% long-term impact rate. And then now you're impacting people to go to work, impacting a whole job place because, you know, a potential shutdown of a business because you decided not to take a degree of personal responsibility to those around you, because that can happen. It's been seen over and over again. One person gets infected, someone can find themselves in the hospital, but it ends up closing a business, results in massive testing, contact tracing, and panic caused by one individual.
Yeah, it's a domino effect, absolutely. So it's not just you, it's that ripple in the pond that spreads out for miles.
Well, there's that little couple from China that traveled through, I think, like four cities and, you know, in maybe I think more than four cities throughout China and spreading disease all over the place, causing a massive inconvenience for whole cities because over there, they shut down the city and mandate testing for millions immediately. And they do fully closed lockdown. You know, obviously we don't have that level of that behavior here by the government. For those who don't know what a lockdown looks like, I mean, they literally close the city. You don't leave your home. I mean, the roads closed. I mean, everything shut down. Not like this, you know, you can still go to the supermarket kind of situation here. You can't go anywhere. So, but I mean, you know, I suspect, I don't think it's been reported by state media in China, but I think there's, I'd be hard for us to believe the communist government is not thinking of some kind of penalism, penalization for those persons that have inconvenienced tens and tens of millions of people.
And there is the difference between communism and democracy.
different levels of accountability by the government of what they expect out of you.
Right. We are recording this tacky on November 17th, which is supposed to be the last full day of the legislative session on Beacon Hill. Is that going to be the case?
I believe so. Today, we're going to do community hospital funding. This is an issue that was addressed at the close of last session, but the Senate didn't agree to the House version. So telemedicine reform is essentially what you saw. Telemedicine and other types of COVID-related healthcare reforms came out at the end of last session, which is the beginning of this year, actually, given how a legislative calendar works. Right. And the speaker would like to, again, address the community hospital funding disparity issue. I'm not going to sit here and explain healthcare law. I do not pretend I'm a healthcare law expert. But the short of it, he's trying to ensure that certain segments of the healthcare industry pay their fair share in equivalent to other aspects of the healthcare industry. Certain industries, particularly outpatient ones like MRIs, for example, are generally private companies, outpatient services. Mm-hmm. He wants to create some equity regarding various, I'm not saying specific MRI, but, you know, various healthcare industries out there that aren't contributing to the overall healthcare system, and divert some of that money collected into our community hospital system.
Yeah, well, he's keenly aware of its impact, given the loss of Quincy Medical Center, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, next closest community hospital is actually South Shore Hospital. You know, we have Cape Cod Hospital going southbound. You have in the Berkshires, Berkshire Hospital. And, you know, over the past 10 years, we've had a number of hospital closures besides Quincy Medical Center. I mean, North Adams lost a hospital, for example. I'm trying to think of any others off the top of my head. But, you know, there's been significant impact on community hospitals statewide.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's, you know, some equity needs to happen for sure in order to provide adequate care to these communities. You know, as opposed to having the whole state have to travel into Boston.
And being speaker, he's really a statewide officer, and Speaker Ron has to think big picture all the time as part of his job. Yes, the speaker really does care about his district, and it's been demonstrated in the budget and bills and, you know, his showing up at district events and so forth, that, you know, his district is always a priority. However, he has a greater responsibility to the members of the House, as well as statewide, working with both the Senate president and the governor. So, you know, when I said, as I always say, the big three, right, the governor, Senate president, and speaker, and run the state at the end of the day in terms of final negotiations. So, you know, Ron, you know, Speaker is very acutely aware of, you know, the needs around the Commonwealth. And as his election speaker, he was he demonstrated a strong commitment to the membership that he will not ignore people's districts. And that's how we got elected. I mean, it's a very important thing for individual members to have a leader that recognizes the unique needs throughout the state.
Yeah. I know one of, if not one of the biggest challenge really is the allocation of the federal pandemic stimulus funds in Massachusetts. Where's that going, Tacky?
Well, the Senate had completed their debate around, thank God, actually right around the Veterans Day.
Yep.
They had a long night, Wednesday night to Thursday morning. And the bill is in conference committee as of Monday. The hope is that we'll have a conference committee report done by today.
Wow.
Perhaps this evening before we close session. However, there is no guarantee of that. There is similar dollar amounts in the bottom in terms of spending, but the internal components of what they're spending on, it has some discrepancies between the House and the Senate. Whether they can reach a resolution before close of session tonight remains to be seen.
Okay.
So the hope is to try to get something to the governor's desk by end of night, but you know, we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, I know we had talked last week a little bit about how it would impact Quincy. Any changes to that?
No, in conference committee, we'll wait and see. We're always hopeful that having a speaker in the city, as well as for people in Weymouth and Holbrook, is a positive thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, since last we talked too, the federal infrastructure package has become law. So as I understand it, that filters down to the state and then to cities and towns.
Yeah, it's a 10-year program, the $1 trillion. So people should not expect $1.2 trillion to be dropped overnight. It's a 10-year program. You know, it's like the opera bill is a 3 to 5 year spending program, which we're dealing with. So I only see the news reports like you, and the rough number is something starting at about 8 or 9 billion. It could be as high as 12. And then, you know, there may be some other directed monies that, you know, we may not have discretion as a state government. You know, for example, you know, they'd be directing money towards broadband again, right? Things like that. So it won't be discretionary. But we're hoping that, you know, it is at least $9 billion of discretionary funds, and it gives opportunity for me to look at roads and other capital projects at home to try to accelerate its completion with infusion of cash over X number of years as the project continues.
Yeah.
So shovel ready is kind of rather important. But again, this is not a $1.2 trillion in like 1 year drop. It's
okay. It's
a multi-year issue. Capital projects, as you all experience in life, road projects feel like they're forever because it takes time to put a road together.
Right. Right.
So, you know, it'll be spent over the mortal course of days. And, you know, right now, you know, there's a lot of places that are high risk structural issues. I don't think it's in Quincy at the moment that is high risk structural, but around the state, there are. And, you know, the goal, again, is to try not to dump all the money in the city of Boston.
Yeah.
Try to get a good dispersion on priorities, especially starting up high risk structures and moving down to people's local projects over a decade.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And also, as I understand, some of it is not direct allocation. Some of it Is competitive grants. I know that the mayor here in Quincy is already gearing up to put together kind of a special team, if you will, to write those grants.
Well, yeah, you know, it's always going to be a grant component. I mean, the state and the feds have always have grants associated with this.
Yeah.
And municipalities that have existing grant writing strategies should be ready to pursue this federal grant monies. So I think you're going to see a mad dash. And of course, smaller communities are a little bit more challenged regarding grant writing because of smaller resources. But a city like Quincy and, you know, cities like Cambridge and Fall River, you know, Lawrence, you know, other mids, you know, not Boston or Worcester size, right? I mean, the rest of us cities, so to speak, you know, should be in a good position to make applications for this because we have more resources and we also have more roads.
Right. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how it impacts employment, the economy, you know, just the overall financial well-being of the state and the country.
Absolutely. A lot of us saw during the height of COVID last year when nobody was driving, really, very little people on the road. I mean, it was a great time that DPW went out and did a whole lot of work on patching and starting construction. This infrastructure bill is going to have actually an important part of economy. We've talked to this about a little bit about the fact that construction by nature creates a lot of job stimulus, not for jobs directly on site, but also all the ancillary things that is required for a construction job, ranging from food services all the way down to concrete to buying shovels. You know, you have a lot of spinoff effects associated with major construction projects. And the idea that we can fund a decade's worth of construction projects in Massachusetts means that we have now a part of our economy to be very stable and will be recession resistant in whenever the next recession shows up, because the COVID screwed up the entire cyclical nature of our economy. Yes. Whenever we figure it out, but economists figure out what the cycle looks like now. You know, things like major construction helps buffer against recessions. And we saw that with the Big Dig.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
The Big Dig did not stop a recession, but was a very good buffer against a couple of recessions regarding what could have been on a huge economic impact.
Oh, yeah. I know people that worked the Big Dig that were able to retire comfortably because of it, that might not have otherwise. So, you know, and it had a ripple effects, I'm sure, that we're not even aware of.
Yeah. And this will be a ripple effect statewide as opposed to a specific geographic area of the state.
Right. Yeah. It also might impact, you know, what like today's 13-year-olds, you know, follow for their career path in the future. If it's a 10-year allocation, I mean, they could follow a career path down in the vocations and certainly have a way to go through that.
Absolutely. And also gives, again, there's some money in still in cash for in the ARPA trust fund the state's holding for capital projects. We have some more cash on hand. And, you know, this also doesn't deny us the ability to put together another transportation or capital improvement bond bill down the road. We're still working on the current set of bond bills. So it gives us also opportunity down the road to reissue or issue new bonds sometime down the road with the federal funding components, knowing that it's there, and you know, continuation of trying to upgrade and beef up our existing infrastructure system.
Yep, absolutely. Good stuff. Good stuff to look forward to. Certainly, we need. We think we all need that right now. It's something positive to look forward to.
Yes, and this is what we call, you know, long-term public policy, right?
It's
something we'll see the impact of, and what's unfortunately going to happen, and this happens as human nature, is that we start to get used to it. So after the official impact of this type of public policy of the influx of funds, then, you know, by year three, people just accept like it's normal. And then, you know, it's not good, by the way, when people accept it's normal, because it does have an end date. And people are always shocked when the end date comes in a decade. They're like, oh my God, what do you mean it ends? I'm like, well, were you at the beginning? But I mean, that's just a human behavior I've noticed in government my whole life. People just get used to an idea, even though you know that there's a deadline.
Right. Yeah. You can kind of put that part out of your mind.
Yeah. Guys like me have to keep these things in his head. I can't promise I'll be here in a decade, but, you know, it's kind of part of my thought process in the big picture, long-term thing. If I'm given another term by the voters, I am running again next year, folks. So if you guys let me come back, I mean, this is actually part of my thinking process on a lot of things, but you know, one little narrow segment I do think about is you know, local capital improvements and, and things like that. So this will impact my thinking on how I go about asking for funds, allocation of funds, and advocacy and prioritization working with the city. But also, you know, I have my own thoughts on matters beyond the city, right? So, this changes my thinking a lot.
Yeah, no, of course you have to be aware of your colleagues on Beacon Hill too. Everything affects everything else, certainly. Where does the state kind of stand on renewable energy and green energy right now, Jackie? Is it near its goal or on its way to achieving its goal?
Well, if you saw an election day, what happened in Maine?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and the audience like looking, I was like, why do we care about Maine? When we did the hydroelectric purchase bill from Hydro-Quebec, Hydro-Quebec came with the lowest bid. Actually, that was not a big surprise by many of us because Hydro-Quebec is the biggest hydro plant you're going to find in this corridor. We had to get the power down here. The existing transmission lines were last upgraded, I think, in like 88 and 94.
Yeah, they're antiquated. Yeah.
They're antiquated for the size of power we need to bring down. And there's only so much you can put into that wire. So a part of your electric bill was going to pick up a portion of the cost associated with building a new transmission line via Maine. And Maine was upset about the fact that they really received no benefit from this transmission line. And I think all of us in this call here understand that kind of frustration. I'm going to build a big power line for Massachusetts people, right? So I think everyone here understands that logic. So what happened is that there's a lot of legal battles going on in Maine against Hydro-Quebec specifically, and they put a ballot question about whether or not you should allow a line to be built. And ballot questions about wording. And people, I think, undervalue this about ballot question. The wording affects how you're psychologically think about the question. And the wording basically said that, you know, do you really want to impact your environment by having a big transmission line coming through your state, essentially.
It was already a pre-drawn conclusion as to how that was going to come out.
It didn't take much of a thought. And of course, Mainers are like, why are you doing this to us and we get nothing?
Right.
So, I mean, other than jobs, I mean, building a transmission line will need a lot of local work. But at the end, I mean, it failed miserably. I mean, it succeeded miraculously, not the other way. The Hydro-Quebec failed miserably, and the proponents against the people against the transmission line won. So this is going to slow down our receiving hydropower.
Yep.
And I suspect this is going to go to federal court because transmission lines are a combination of state and federal oversight because transmission lines are across state lines. So Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has oversight over any transmission line that crosses between states. Now, a transmission line for anybody who's wondering that it doesn't do utility or electricity, transmission lines are those massive 200-foot tall monster lines. You see a lot of clear-cut trees around them because the transmission line goes down. It's hard to put one back up. It's not like, you know, in front of your house in a pole.
Right.
The distribution lines are the lines that are that go to your house. So transmission goes into distribution goes to your house, and then there's a transformer that helps out, and the capacitors on the poles, you see those little buckets, and then you have the conversion from a higher voltage to a lower voltage, your fuse box, and then you know you have the lower voltage in your home and so forth. So without the transmission line, you can't get to distribution, obviously. And like I said, it's probably going to go to court about whether or not the state can even stop a transmission line construction and whether it's completed under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to approve. This also applies to gas lines as well, but it doesn't apply to telecommunications, which is mostly unregulated in this country under the Telecom Act of 1996.
Okay, interesting. So do you think that's going to impact energy or rates here in the short term?
Not yet. The construction transmission line will be picked up by ratepayers in Massachusetts on the transmission part of your bill. It'll be evenly distributed through the whole state, but it's also evenly distributed but scaled based on your rate class. So industrial commercial customers pay more than residential, but residential represents like 85% plus of all customers in Massachusetts on electricity. So one of the biggest user of electricity is actually the MBTA.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that at all. Interesting. For the third rail subway system.
Yep. So having hydropower and wind power actually has a huge indirect effect on everything around here regarding a more renewable energy access. The opera bill that the House included money for construction of windmills in the South Coast because Block Island's moving along trying to get those windmills up. And the goal is to have not just renewable power, but jobs here in the South Coast to build this renewable power or even just assembly of the renewable power of these windmills. And we're talking blades of like 100 feet long minimum. I
Yeah,
mean,
this is not a little propeller you put up in your backyard.
no, yeah, absolutely. This is monstrous metal construction going on. So there's more for those on this call looking at renewable power issues. There are multiple components to this, but again, we don't generate that much renewable power in Massachusetts for a lot of reasons. Partially, we don't have perfect wind, which is why they're out in Block Island. And then we don't have great solar because it's about less than 25% efficiency because of the nature of Massachusetts weather. So as a result, Hydro-Québec is pretty much 99% reliable. And obviously we want to get off fossil fuels, but we need that transmission line through Maine to get us off of fossil fuels.
Well, stay tuned for that one. Speaking of telecommunications, it reminded me about the bill on Beacon Hill regarding streaming services and how that might impact peg centers like us here at QATV.
Yeah, Telecommunications and Energy, run by Jeff Roy out of, where's he, Franklin?
Think so.
I think so. Yeah, I had lunch with him. I'm trying to remember where it was. I think it was Franklin. Yeah, this I don't know where things are. I live in Quincy. I never leave the city. Most people knows I don't even leave my house anymore.
But you got your hair cut, so it looks, you've gone out sometimes.
I know my physical appearance gives you a clue if I've left the house, right? I actually do not know a status of your bill. A lot of bills have not been reported out of committee yet. Most chairs are trying to work towards their joint rule 10 deadline on February 2nd on reporting all bills. Most committees have not released a lot. I mean, my committee is actually one of the rare committees that have released over 30 bills so far. So I've already released about 10% of the bills in my committee with favorable reports. But also, I've been chair of this committee since 2017, and I got a staff that's very experienced, and I also have a co-chair that's been wonderful to work with in terms of learning curve. She's very good in learning curve, but not all chairs are created equal, not all staffs are created equal. And then the speaker had installed a lot of new chairmen who are chairs for the first time. A lot of people when you're working new subject matters. So the answer is I do not know where your bill is. I suspect the bill has not been reported out yet because the word around the building, via text messaging from friends. Is that people chairs are still trying to work towards joint rule 10. So I'm not the norm. I have some intrinsic institutional advantages, but I'm very conscious that a lot of my colleagues are doing this for the first time.
Okay, I know we thank you for your support. I know that you support it, so that's great.
And in case people don't know what the bill is about, it's giving community cable access the ability to be in high definition.
Yes, so we can see us more clearly.
So yeah, obviously you can write to your delegation, but we already know. But as obviously if you have friends that are not in Quincy, you want to talk about high definition quality cable access community-based programming, obviously reach out to your friends in other communities to see if they can get the representative support to go. And watch what happens now. I'm going to get a bunch of emails I've just created asking me support bill that I just talked about. I think I would sponsor a bill, and it goes, "Dear Representative Chan, I'm asking you to co-sponsor Representative Chan's bill." I get those.
Do you
I
really?
was like, "I just scratch my head." I'm like, "Really?"
Well, obviously, it's somebody hasn't vetted that at all. It's just a generic letter gone out.
Absolutely, but it does, create a little bit of a chuckle for me. But yeah, no, folks. I mean, that does happen. You're right. It's a form letter. People just want to be a participant in government, and they just copy and paste, or it's a robo email, it's generated remote, robotically, automated to my inbox. But it's you can't but just help you can't have you just can't help laugh. Dear Representative Tacky Chan, please sponsor Representative Tacky Chan's bill. I'm like, it's not doing me.
You should write back and say, no, I'm not sponsoring my own
No,
bill.
not sponsoring this bill. Not doing it. Yeah, just welcome to the inner workings of things I deal with. That's questionable, which is what's great about doing this type of podcast.
Exactly. Yeah, we get the behind the scenes insight into it. Speaking of ballot questions, do we know what's going to be on the ballot next year for ballot questions here in Massachusetts?
Not quite yet. I'm watching Stato's news service for those reports to come in. They get it actually somewhat faster than I will, because it's not like I get direct email from the AG's office or the secretary's office telling us what's on the ballot. I do actually also rely on news service, by the way, because they're generally like right on it all the time. Because I'm not
sitting. That's their name.
Well, yeah, I'm not sitting at the Secretary of State's office waiting for the information, right?
Right.
So that's news. You know, that's why we do news service in my work to help with that. And December 1st is the deadline to put the papers in the Secretary of State's office. Today is when everything's got to get to clerk's offices, just like nomination papers. So a lot of advocates who are looking to put ballot questions do news press releases regarding their progress on going into clerk's offices.
Right.
Because they don't wait to the last minute, obviously. It's like me and my nomination papers. We put them in as quickly as we get. Yep. It's done. Right. So, you know, there should be some press releases from advocacy groups to news services indicating, you know, we think, you know, we've made the cut because we've collected, you know, out of 80,000 plus requirement, you know, 80,237 or whatever. Whatever the number is, you know, we've collected, you know, 170,000 signatures, only needing 80,000. So we're waiting to see if those people start putting into news service that information. It gives them a bit of a clue what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. It's not just signatures, though, right? I mean, it has to be deemed constitutional also, does it not?
It does, but the AG did that already this summertime.
Oh.
The constitutional vetting occurs prior to signature collection. However, lawsuits on ballot questions occur after the first round of signatures.
Okay, all right.
So when you question the AG's determination of constitutionality and you're any other private entity, you can actually implement a lawsuit after the first round of signatures when it becomes a bill at the State House to question the constitutionality, and it goes straight to the Supreme Court about this constitutionality. And the AG isn't always right, right? Mm-hmm. And the court has in the past struck down questions because they didn't meet constitutional requirements.
Yeah. Of course, yeah. You wouldn't incur the expense of filing a lawsuit if it looked like it wasn't going to go anywhere anyway.
Yeah, the last one they did that to was the ballot question on increasing your taxes on, the millionaire's tax was a ballot question. Where they want to change the constitution, which we keep, you know, it's coming to your ballot, by the way, this coming November in 2022. But I mean, the first, before they went through the constitutional method in the State House, they tried a direct ballot question. The court ruled that the problem with it is that not just because of the flat changing the flat tax system required in the Constitution, but also it directs the legislature how to spend.
Mm-hmm.
Spending power in state constitution is solely in the purview of the legislature, starting with the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
Solely. So you cannot actually direct the legislature to spend money.
Okay. It has to be voted on by the body.
Correct. It is a specific right. It's not like California. California doesn't have that provision, which is why California's budget is always a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Because like 60% plus or 70% of the budget, it was dictated by ballot question.
I see.
So it makes a very, I know it's a huge economy. It's a $3 trillion plus economy. You know, was it 40 plus million people? I know it's a huge state. Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, when the voters vote to tell you what's in the budget, it really defeats the point of having people like me around.
Well, yeah, because what if the money's not there? then where does it come from? You know, they have to have, I mean, you see overrides out there all the time.
And it's not the voters' problem. The voters voted for it. And it's like the voters have to deal with it. That's the lawmakers' problem. As you can tell, I'm not that warm to ballot questions, as you can tell. But yeah, I mean, this is just the reality of the life here, and it's constitutional process is provided by the state constitution. So, but that is an example where the AG ruled something is valid, and Supreme Court ruled against the AG. You know, on that particular constitutional grounds, they've ruled against the AG on things like more than one question. The bill actually has to address one singular issue.
Okay.
One, it can be a 10-page bill, but it has to address one single issue questions. So, I mean, those sometimes has been knocked out as well by the Supreme Court, who has a different opinion from the AG what one question looks like.
Right. Yeah. Ah, yes, democracy in action. what do you think? Mail-in early voting becoming permanent?
Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to make it to a close of today on mail-in voting. I do believe the House and Senate have actually strong intention to do mail-in voting. I think we're probably going to table this one into January. The reality is the 2022 elections, there is no presidential primary, which is good in this instance. And the primaries aren't going to be till September and November. Realistically speaking, folks, on a practical timeline, you know, we get this something done the first 3 months of next year. Still plenty of time for the secretariats and city and clerks to adjust their budgets for the ballot. And of course, you know, we always can provide some, we actually do provide funding to Secretary Galvin's office regarding operation of elections. So if we, you know, we go down this route, and I think we will, there's still plenty of time in terms of practical implementation. So that's what we really should be looking out for, the practical implication, not the sense of urgency regarding the passage of mail-in ballots.
Okay. Yeah. It might be a little soon for like the town meetings, you know, municipal elections in the springtime, but local communities can deal with that.
That's correct. And, it, you know, it has the biggest, you know, by far the biggest impact on big races. And we now have another sampling size. You know, last year was a statewide sampling. This year's big city sampling. We'll there'll be obviously studies done by various not-for-profit, you know, groups out there that are independently evaluating the impact and the pros and cons of mail-in ballots in municipal elections. So, you know, new service will be seeing reports coming out at some point down the road about, you know, whether the success rate, whether increased voter turnout, you know, and things like that. So then the clerks have been fairly positive. I give a lot of credit to the clerks in the state for running very smooth and secure elections. And a lot of the hiccups that occurred last year has been smoothed up for municipal elections.
Yeah, definitely. Any more blowback on the redistricting, Tacky, that you've heard?
No, now we're into congressional. My side's done. So doesn't matter what I think anymore. Too late. But there is a hoo-ha, I think, to say. I'm now sounding like an ancient using the word hoo-ha. Yeah. But I mean, the Southeast Coast has a huge debate, as you saw in the newspapers, regarding whether to keep Fall River and New Bedford together, to keep Fall River split, you know, between Congressman Uckercross as well as Congressman Keating. And this has become a bit of a battle zone at the State House for those delegations in the South Coast. So stay tuned. I mean, anything moves everything around. And of course, there's a degree of politics and all this stuff. And there's some practical issues, for example. I mean, everybody in the western side of the state's heading east. Nope, there's not enough people out in the western part of the state. You got to go. And the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court ruled that you only have a one-person margin.
Wow. Okay.
I got a 5% margin. They get one person margin. So, you know, the Redistricting Committee has a very a tall haul to get to 1%. One-person margin between congressional districts. Wow.
What if that, what if, you know, the status of a voter changes during that process?
Well, no, it's residency. Now, it's whatever the census vote.
Okay.
So it's residency. So whatever the census count comes up, whatever that number in that census block is, you know, you have to move people around in a manner that ensures that every congressional person in Massachusetts only has a one-person differential from each other.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah, that's tough when you think about it. That's much tougher than dealing with state senator and state rep districts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Is there a deadline for when that has to happen?
We're trying to, I believe the deadline has to be by year's end.
Okay.
So we've got to get something on the governor's desk. They, on the Constitution, the residency requirement for running for congressional seats are very different from us. So there's more time to put this together. And again, there's also a practical aspect regarding ballot printing, So when, like all of us, when we move to 22 election cycle, there'll be new ballots reflecting new districts. We will, you know, like with the mail-in ballots, you know, we get in you know, sometime in early 2022, there'll be plenty of time for people to sort that out.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, very good. What else is going on locally in your district we should know about?
Well, I mean, which third rails do you want to touch today?
That's up to you. How many emails do you want to get?
There's a lot of truth to that, actually. I'm a troll and want to cause for myself. I suppose I'll be remiss. I can't escape the Quincy High School situation.
I was going to see if you were going to bring that up. Yeah.
Well, you could have brought it up. I mean, I can't stop you. All I can do is dodge and weave on my side, right? I should make you dodge and weave one day. That'd be fun.
Go right ahead.
if people want to see role reversal between me and Joe, please email Joe to tell you want to see role reversal.
Oh, nobody will email me. I'm not worried about that.
No, I can't. I probably should. I do have to actually address this at some level. And they also occurred in Braintree as well on the following Monday. And it was a discussion of possibly a walkout situation, I believe, in not Parker.
Point Webster.
Point Webster. Yeah, the P school, Point Webster. And of course, you've seen the situation in Danvers and Indies, which is really tough. And I'm not going to get to the details of the incidents because I only know about my knowledge of these incidents is the extent of your knowledge in instances regarding what you read in the news. Mm-hmm. And I've not looked at social media commentary on this because I'm sure there's plenty of social media commentary by adults, most likely, mm-hmm. or kids regarding the circumstances here. There's no secret I grew up in the city. It's no secret that I grew up in the city here at the end of White Flight, right, in Boston. I mean, born in 73. You guys know I'm older than I look. And, you know, I'm a child in the 80s. You know, I've seen my share of racial turmoil. And I would say I've been fortunate in the sense that I didn't have as bad as other people for the fact that I don't leave my house. Other folks, as you can look up at the Patriot Ledger archives from the late 80s, where they have documented really bad racism. In Quincy, documented by the Patriot Ledger in the late 80s. You can look it up in the archives. It's very disturbing. And you saw the obituary from Mayor McCauley about all the work in progress he did regarding getting translators and recognizing the diverse community coming in through the 80s and, you know, and beefing up the need to keep immigrants and refugees and residents in general safe. The Quincy High School situation, you don't get to that point unless things are really bad. I think the way to put it, you don't get 200 plus kids walking out of a school if they didn't feel like that had been hurt. Mm-hmm. It's not one or two kids. This is clearly a movement of folks who are of the same mind about how the system is operating. I've heard folks kind of dismiss this a little bit, like kids don't know better, teenagers aren't that smart, and so forth and so forth. Obviously, I've heard those same comments. And, you know, I'm not claiming to be a genius high schooler, but, you know, they communicate more now. And, you know, I grew up in the era of cliques, right? Everyone's in the silos, so-called mean girls, so-called jocks, so-called nerds, so-called honor society folks, so-called, right? You guys all know what I'm talking about. If you all should hopefully know what I'm talking about. But, you know, with modern communication, these walls break down and isolation becomes different. Because if you're able to communicate with another student to have the same experience as you have, you know, you're not alone. You're not isolated situation. It becomes what I refer to as a systemic problem. Mm. Do I know the severity of it? No. Do I know the details of every incident? No. Am I troubled by the fact that that this has happened? Yes. Not because that it's not productive, not because it's uninformed. It's an indication the kids know more than I think we do as adults. Mm. Something's happening here. And that's what's going on. And there, I attended a webinar on Friday, and I also was at the focus group type sessions on a Monday evening at Quincy High School. And I did stand out for a little bit in the cold because I only could take so much, I discovered. I listened to a little bit of what was being said by the students outside. And, you know, here's my attitude. And I said it three different times at this point, so it's kind of a public statement. Growing up here and seeing who runs our government and seeing who runs our school systems and growing up in the same life I've grown up here, they should, one, not be surprised there's issues regarding race. Two, you would hope their life experience in Quincy would lead them to a better operation, that this would never have needed to happen. And those of us watching us know that this is a city government where everybody knows everybody. Mm-hmm. Let's be frank about it. And they grew up in the city too, like myself. But clearly, because of their life experience, my life experience, which is different from my from the kids now life experience, there's clearly a disconnect because they should never have reached this stage. They shouldn't have. And my comments in the ledger, you know, on Monday had a little piece missing because I, you know, mentioned to a reporter that this could never, ever happen when I was young because there was never enough of us to relate to our problems.
Yeah. Even the school administration itself has acknowledged in talks that I've had with them that the staff and, you know, the administration of the schools needs to be better representative of the student body in terms of racial diversity. So they are aware of that, at least, you know, and they're working towards that goal. But it doesn't sound like it's happening quick enough, for, at least for some students.
It's not just about just racial representation. It's about whether or not the system itself is willing to change its mentality and habits to adjust and respond to their constituencies. Why do I say that? Well, I do constituencies, right? And it's, you know, it's very simple. I mean, government, when government has to force you to change, for example, special education in the 70s, the ADA, you know, English second language classes, that's government needing to tell school systems, you guys weren't paying attention. State government should not need to do that.
Right.
And who advocates for those children to get those services? Adults, the parents, the advocates of parents, past parents. And it's not uniquely issues from the 70s and the 80s, even the 90s and 2000s regarding transgender, gay, lesbian, you know, equal opportunity, equity and spending in school systems, not usually just Quincy, but other school systems about equitable spending through the system. Those are the responsibility of adults. And it's not the responsibility of kids having to advocate for that. That's our responsibility as adults. And I do not have kids in the system. Just, I still haven't figured that's part of my life out, folks. And we'll leave it at that right now because people ask that a lot about me. But I mean, that is the responsibility of adults to bring this up to government saying, hey, I just found out. And that's okay, they just found out. But they do, adults should be asking these hard questions of our government. But what are you doing and why this happened? What is the stimulus? Because, you know, they put the pressure on the kids, and I get there's a lot of pressure on kids these days, I think, in schools. But, you know, it's still up to adults to be adults on the matter. And when the kids have to become adults to address their issues they're suffering under, or they have a grievance, or they have something they think that needs to change, adults aren't doing their job.
I guess the first step is listening, right? So according to the administration, at least, they're going to have many more of these forums that you attended, these listening sessions, if you will.
I actually share the concerns of the students on this one because I've been around a long time, folks. I've heard of the word listening a lot. And I agree with the students. I don't see a lot of action in the city.
Okay.
And for the edification, you guys all wonder, because I get this question also. No one's talked to me. Whether it be the DEI issue in the mayor's office, we've talked about here on the call, with the city council and the mayor, nor the school systems actually have any discussions with me. And I'll give you my favorite example most recently, because I've heard stories about fights in Atlantic, I've heard fights at North Quincy High. You know, things do get back to me over the course of 26 years in this business. But one of the things that, you know, in 2019, November, there's a swastika drawn on the school at Beechwood Knoll. I live a stone throw away from Beechwood Knoll. I mean, it was the elementary school from K to two I was at. And I was actually on vacation, a prepping vacation, happened right over Thanksgiving Day weekend. I was getting on a plane right after Thanksgiving Day weekend. So I was like scrambling to get my act together. on my last vacation prior to COVID, and no one told me. I don't know, person of color, swastika, school, I live by one. Probably doesn't affect me. I'm very doubtful it's directed at me, but it does raise that question that warning signs were there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the city council we saw did pass, a department of diversity, equity, inclusion. The administration decided not to fund it. There's been no action on a mayoral commission to look into that matter. The evidence suggests that not a lot has happened right now.
And the signs were already there. Again, you know, the doubts need to be adults. I just found out that one of the members of the mayor's commission resigned.
Oh.
Yeah. Gabriel Chung resigned from the commission, I found out. So, news travels. There's no secrets in the city. Eventually things get around. And, you know, I'm in the business of basically learning about what's going on around me. And I do have some experience on this, and I have more experience than the counselors and a lot of people in administrations of different parts of city government. So, and I have a completely different point of view, obviously. Mm-hmm. And being in an elected position gives me a greater point of view. And I'm not a statewide office, but I do have spent time talking to other folks in other communities, as well as my colleagues about what's going on and here and there. And, until COVID hit, you know, I do enjoy spending some time in other communities, learning about how things are done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We talk about Asian racism, right? And people pretend there is nothing here. And we know that's not true. And, and people are going to stop pointing fingers at specific advocacy groups like BLM or accusing like Anti-Defamation League or the ACLU for causing trouble and whatnot. You know, I'm very aware that people are saying things like that, right? And, you know, that's just saying that, well, it's one or two. It's not really a problem. Well, 250 kids plus walked out. You know, a middle school was thinking about walking out. A school did walk out in Braintree.
Mm-hmm.
And Danvers is in a crisis mode,
mm-hmm.
Trying to understand how this could have happened in a becoming more affluent community. But Danvers is becoming more affluent.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm watching and waiting to see how this unfolds. I'm not a local official. I mean, I'm a state official. I do have an opinion of myself, of course, like
mm-hmm.
everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also watching and waiting to see, not necessarily how the kids respond. I'm watching and waiting to see how the adults respond. And that focus group was actually very educational. And we did promise the folks not to reveal what other people said. But it was also very educational for me to hear about diversity of opinions in my focus group. I took enormous value in that. I could relate to some of the things people said. And honestly, some of the folks talk about stuff that I lived through and I understand what they're getting at as well.
Yeah.
It was a diverse group of folks in the focus group. It wasn't one specific demographic. I will tell you that. And I shared my thoughts on the matter, which is very similar to what I just said here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what happens at the public school system ends up in my court in terms of constituent services and in my court regarding people advocating for different bills and whatnot, because people think like schools are just this microcosm that stays there. Is there? It isn't. Whenever a freshman or middle school or elementary school, it doesn't matter, it leaves those four walls. You know, now whatever happened at school, you know, goes into the general community. And I agree this parental responsibility. I agree the school responsibility. And I agree the student responsibility.
Okay.
And all three groups. And there's a responsibility to the government. But I see what happens when I talk to parents about their experience of QPS and their kids' experiences after the bell rings at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So it's not in the four walls of the school. It impacts everything outside those four walls, including what happens in your own home as a parent or a guardian, as well as someone like me who takes constituent services and listens to people's concerns, whether it be a student, a young adult, or a parent or a guardian.
How do folks share more of their thoughts with you, Tacky?
617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. That's the number. Smash a button, get to a staff voicemail. We're still working remote, but we're working hard and getting back to people as quickly as we can. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov is my email. As I said time and time again, I get a lot of email. I think I just created some more. Now, social media, I do not respond to much at all. I prefer you email me. You know, State Representative Tacky Chan is my public Facebook. You know, I do post some useful information. You can see where I've been, as well as the public hearing executive sessions of my committee. So, you know, you want to see how the job works, such as it is in the current format. You're also welcome to peruse that. And of course, you know, QATV's website and YouTube, and, you know, the podcast, Yo Joe's, and got old ones. And I fully admit, I'm going to get in trouble for all my past podcasts. I just have a hard time not believing I'm going to get myself not in trouble. But, you know, you can review things I've said and discovering I didn't say certain things correctly and I had to correct myself later. So.
Well, that just shows you're human like the rest of us, Tacky. Should we catch up again? I know the legislature's coming to an end, but we always seem to have things to talk about.
Oh, absolutely. Just because the session closes doesn't mean there's not new news to talk about, whether it be in the legislature or in the federal level or local news. And even pending public policies that not reached fruition yet, that is still in conversation. And there's no shortage of public policies that people are still in conversation about.
Yep. Okay, great. We'll look forward to that then. And I will bid you adieu for another week.
I'll see you next week, Joe.